This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 330 was recorded on June 30th, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. MI2 Partners founder Julian Brigden returns as this week's feature interview guest. Julian was one of the first Macro Voices guests to sound the warning bell on inflation, and now he says there's plenty of room for both markets and the economy to get worse before they get better. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick's chart deck will be titled Snapshot of the Intermarkets. And finally, a quick message to our listener, Alexi F., who kindly offered to broker introductions for an interview we're extremely interested in. Alexi, we're very interested in the guest that you proposed to introduce us to, but your email box at iCloud.com has been over quota for a solid week, so our several replies to your email have all bounced back. Please email us again from a different email account.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's jump straight to it. The S&P 500 down 11 points. We were down over 50 points at one point, but I think the more relevant thing is that after a strong Friday rally, the market has given it all back. And that pattern, which we'll talk about as well in the post game on a chart, is that every rally seems to be failing. There's ample distribution available, and the markets just seem so heavy still, and there's no sign of a bottom, in my opinion. What's your take on the S&P?
Well, exactly as you just said, Patrick, it feels to me like we're kind of on a three-week cycle of our Macro Voices episodes here, where we have an episode where the story is, oh boy, equities are technically oversold. Surely there's got to be at least a bounce coming. Then next week, it's okay, here comes the bounce, but will it have legs? And then we get to the end of the cycle where we are this week, which is, oops, looks like it's starting to roll over again. Maybe next week we'll be back to completing the cycle one more time to the downside. We'll see what happens. I still think less than 3,000 on the S&P before this bear market is finally over and the recession is fully priced in. But let's see what Julian Brigden has to say in this week's feature interview.
All right, well, let's move on to that dollar index. There was a legit breakdown earlier in the euro. The dollar index was decisively above 105, at least earlier today. And then a bit of an intraday reversal before we're recording here, giving a lot of it back. And we're trading right now about 104.65 on the Dixie. What's your thinking here?
You know, despite the short-term noise, as you said, we're still above 104. So as far as I'm concerned, the uptrend is intact. It's not a breakout above that five-year resistance. We're still fighting to get through that resistance level. But, you know, they call them resistance levels for a reason. It might take a while. But I think what's relevant, Patrick, is we haven't rejected that level and traded back down to 97 or anything. You know, we're just holding on here at 104, trying to break through it. Maybe we'll get a pullback before we eventually trade higher. I think eventually what's coming is a break out above 104 and it'll accelerate from there.
All right, well, let's move on to crude oil because it's actually been pretty exciting what's been happening in the last week. Not only did we put some sort of a short-term low in, we had a pretty solid bounce, giving some of it back here. I was looking forward to hearing what your ideas are, what's causing all this volatility.
Well, there's so much going on this week, Patrick. Let's start with EIA inventory. Crude oil drawing down at least the headline number of 2.8 million barrels of commercial inventory. The thing is, that doesn't include another 7 million barrels that was drained recklessly and irresponsibly out of the SPR this week. So you've really got an effective drawdown of 9.7 million barrels. 782,000 barrels coming out of Cushing, Oklahoma this week. That takes us down to 21.2 million barrels. Now, most industry experts consider 20 million to be just about the absolute operational bottom for Cushing. So we're right at effective tank bottoms, not true physical tank bottoms, but at virtual tank bottoms. We're really right there, and you know, it's only the beginning of high demand season. Finished products were the builds on the board. Finally, gasoline building 2.6 million barrels after I lost track of how many consecutive drawdown weeks we had. And distillates also building 2.6 million barrels. We're still at the lowest stocks for this time of year ever, and summer is only just begun. U.S. production ticked up another 100,000 barrels to 12.1 million barrels. Remember all of the analysts who said that the U.S. would never, ever get back to its previous record of 13.3 million barrels that was set just before the COVID crisis took over? Well, guess what? The U.S. oil industry is already most of the way there. They've got about a million barrels to go. I'm confident that they're going to do it and that we're going to get to new all-time highs in production. All I can say to our many listeners who work in the oil patch is thank you for your service at a time when your own government has turned against you, with Gina Haskell, the president's advisor, literally celebrating the loss of jobs in the fossil fuel industry this week. It's really shameful what's going on, and I personally want to thank all of you who work in this industry for the excellent work that you're doing to restore the U.S. energy production capacity. The SPR, Strategic Petroleum Reserve, has now been drained to its lowest level since 1986, below 500 million barrels. Quick back-of-napkin calculation, about 16 months left in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve at the current draw rate. So if we were to continue the present policy of about 7 million barrels a week coming out of the SPR, in 16 weeks, the SPR would be no more. President Biden is literally canceling the flood insurance as the tidal wave comes into sight, approaching shore. Meanwhile, our Macro Voices listeners know for years now I've been talking about how the world is running out of spare capacity. Prince Abdulaziz bin Salman took my side of that argument a few weeks ago. You would have thought that that would make it public knowledge and everybody would know about it. Well, add French President Emmanuel Macron, who in a viral video this week tried to explain this to President Biden, who didn't appear to be listening, saying, look, this whole business about begging the Saudis to increase their production doesn't make any sense. They're already producing as fast as they can. This was explained by Anas Al-Haji a couple of weeks ago. I've been talking about it for months. It seems now that just about everyone, after a video went viral this week showing President Macron trying to explain the concept to President Biden, it seems like everybody gets it now, but still it's not affecting policy. The G7 was talking this week about imposing price caps on Russian oil. And I guess supposedly their strategy was they were going to withhold insurance on any ship that delivered Russian oil unless it was below a certain price level specified by them. That is about the silliest thing I think anyone's ever heard. All I can imagine is they must have known better than to think that could ever work, and they were just saying these things as political theater. In any event, it seems that they finally let go of this silly idea. What scares me is about the dumbest thing that they could possibly do would be to escalate to the level of a physical blockade, where they try to physically prevent ships carrying Russian oil from leaving Russia and taking that oil to India and China and other ready buyers. If that's the stupidest thing that they could possibly do, that tells me it just might happen. So I'm watching for any signs of an escalation to a physical blockade. But I do want to point out that the bull case for oil, and I'm certainly still very bullish long-term on oil prices, there is a logical fallacy there, which is everybody's making this assumption about Russian oil coming off the market. There's really no reason to think that any Russian oil is coming off of any market, for the reasons that Anas Al-Haji explained and that we've discussed here on Macro Voices several times. What's going to happen here is Russia will sell its oil to India and China and other countries who don't care about Western sanctions. And unless and until there's a physical blockade to prevent that from happening, that oil will continue to be consumed. So Russian oil isn't really coming off of the market as a result of Western sanctions. The result of Western sanctions is only to increase prices at the pump for American and European consumers. But I'm going to make, it's not a prediction, but I want to at least point out a possibility that's extremely concerning to me, which is Russia is very much in a position that they could weaponize energy prices come this fall. So just imagine that Russia embarks on a strategy to intentionally first force the current Western sanctions to backfire in President Biden and the European Union's faces, and then invokes his own strategy, which intentionally takes some of that oil off of the market when they're least expecting it. That's an involved and nuanced conversation, so let's save it for the post-game segment. We'll come back to it when we talk about oil in the post-game chart deck. Meanwhile, OPEC Plus met this morning. Basically, at this point, I think any quota decisions they make are irrelevant because they're already peddling as fast as they can. Now, they can't come out and admit that publicly because if OPEC admits that they have no spare capacity, that means that they have no pricing power and the purpose of the organization existing becomes dubious at that point. I think Western leaders know that they have no leverage here, and they keep talking about how they're going to pressure Saudi Arabia to increase its oil capacity. Just as political theater. The American public will buy that story and think the president is trying to do something and blame it on foreigners when in fact the blame rests squarely in the White House where the source of the problems actually exists. Overall, with respect to price action and where we're headed from here, Patrick, you know, usually I feel like I really have my pulse on the oil market because I follow it so closely. There's other times like now when I kind of feel like, feels like somebody knows something that I don't know because I can't really explain that $22 sell-off from $124 down to $101. What really drove that? I don't have a good handle on that. And right now, this bounce, frankly, I think that silly little video about Macron trying to explain spare capacity to Biden probably is what drove the bounce up from 101 and change all the way up to 114 yesterday. Now, as we speak, we're back down to a 105 handle. And I wouldn't be surprised if we end up going and testing the 100-day moving average at a new low around 100 spot 75 or so. From there, the next targets really are the longer moving averages. They're down at 92 and 86. So as far as where we go from here, even a move down to the 200-day moving average would not negate my long-term very bullish view. But at some point, we need to price in a U.S. recession. That hasn't happened yet. It's tempting to say, oh, well, that's what explains the $22 move down. Well, there would be correlation in the stock market if that was the market pricing in the coming recession. So I still think there's another significant move down in prices still to come as the market prices in recession. In any event, Patrick, let's save the rest for the post-game segment when we can go into more detail.
All right, Eric. Well, let's move on to gold because really it's been doing nothing. And to me, it just mirrors the movement of a lot of the cross currencies to the US dollar. It's just the US dollar uptrend is intact. And all of these types of cross currencies and gold and silver continue to just be under substantial pressure and look like there's vulnerability to go lower. What's your take on gold here?
Well, as you say, we gave up all of the moving averages this week. We're trading below them now. We're starting to move into a area of lower volume on the volume profile chart, so that might slow the price action down. We'll see what happens. But it looks to me like gold is rolling over and maybe about to head down significantly. If I couple that with my views on the stock market, as I've said many times before, if the stock market outright crashes, I think it takes gold with it because people just panic and sell everything they've got. And it looks to me like we're at the early stages of maybe setting up for that with both the stock market and the gold market rolling over this week.
All right. And let's just wrap up by touching on that 10-year Treasury yield, which is dipping below 3%. I think a couple ticks like this is not significant yet, but we certainly are at this major pivot. Any bias into what's next for the yields?
Well, the way I'm looking at this, Patrick, is we've held 3% for a week now. That's a good sign. If we were going to have that technical analysis phenomenon we discussed last week, where it's really an upside breakout, but you come down and briefly test the previous resistance level as a support level, that would have been over by now, and we would have been trading higher in yield at this point. That's not happening. So it tells me that we don't really have a solid breakout to the upside in yield in play here. As far as what we do have right now, it's just consolidation around the 3% level. Let's wait until we move off of that 3% level in one direction or the other to see where the next leg is going to take us.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is MI2 Partners founder Julian Brigden. Now, Eric, why did we get Julian back on the show this week?
Well, Julian is a macro veteran. He's one of the most popular guests that we've ever had on Macro Voices, always a listener favorite, and it's been a long time since we had him on. He's also had particularly strong views on what we just discussed, which is treasury yields. So he's going to have plenty to say on treasury yields, both about where the yield is headed and also about the people who predict them.
Eric's interview with Julian is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is MI2 Partners founder Julian Brigden. Julian prepared an excellent slide deck to accompany this week's interview. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button above Julian's picture that says looking for the downloads. Julian, it's been a long time. I think last time I spoke with you, you said something nobody else was saying, which is get ready, put your seatbelt on, inflation is going to get serious. And everybody thought you were crazy. What has happened as one of the people who saw this coming? How has it played out and how's it gone differently, perhaps, than you expected?
So, I mean, to be honest, it's been more powerful than we thought and more persistent than we thought. You know, we wrote at the start of 2021, the first report we wrote, I think the 5th of January or something, 2021, that inflation would be the most important variable of the year. And indeed, it was. But kind of we got to the beginning of 22 and end of 21, and we were expecting some base effects to kick in. And then just things continued. And I think the problem is, Eric, is that we've started this process, which I think of sort of non-linearity, right? I mean, the world, we're very used to a world, you know, companies, central banks, and it was interesting listening to the Cinter conference where we had Powell, Bailey, and Lagarde on. And it's really worth listening to if your readers can listen to this. You know, they talked about the world structurally changing now. Right? Structurally changing. And I think, you know, we're so used to, as market participants, since the Great Moderation started in the mid-80s, this kind of period of relatively benign, relatively predictable, relatively forecastable, kind of, you know, if you want to call it the nice sine wave around the long-term trend of economic growth, where, you know, you grow at kind of 2.5 and central banks come in and they cap it a little bit and we roll over to sort of half and then they cap it a little bit on the bottom and we kind of stay in this nice predictable world, to this increasingly volatile world where things just don't respond in the way that you had thought, right? And even we, who were, as I said, extraordinarily aggressive on the inflation story, were caught out by just how powerful these forces appear to be, because base effects should have started away on inflation starting really at the end of the last year and didn't. And so something else is totally going on. So is it then you have to sort of take a stand back and go, what is it? So is it companies just deciding after 30 years of never being able to push through price increases to go like, screw it, now we can jam them through? And I think there's an element of that, right? Or is it just all these normal relationships that we assumed that would happen break down? I mean, there's a great chart. So as you can see from the next slide on page 2, you can see this excess stimulus model. Where you look at the breakout of inflation, right? And you can take this thing back to 1926, I think. So there you go. That's quite a long time. Not even you and I are that old, Eric. And you look at a range of typically inflationary tops being between max, between like 5.4 and 6.4%, okay, in CPI in the US. If you break that, the lowest next print that we saw was 9.4, and the average was over 13%. And there's been very few periods of that, Eric, but the point is it's material, right? So things have just totally broken down, and the world isn't acting normally. I think it was, as I said, I think that Cinter conference call was hugely important. Because all three central bank governors all acknowledged that this concept that we are necessarily returning back to that nice, benign world where you had globalization, high productivity, all of those factors weighing continuously on inflationary pressures, maybe over for quite some time. And I think that is material. So look, I can see some signs of benign inflation, or should we say peaking inflation, okay, in the US, some. But I think there are, I don't think it's necessarily the case that it's a guaranteed. And in fact, you know, we've got some models that suggest, and maybe I'm being a bit too cute, but they go back to the 1960s. But if I look at, you know, the size of the stimulus, and I think this is really the key point here, and you can look at that, the next slide, and you can see that. You can see that if I look at the stimulus and the size, it was five times bigger than anything that we've seen in post-war history, Eric. And it suggests when you use it to try and forecast inflation, it doesn't see a peak until Q4, right? Now, I don't want to get too cute on this, but you can see it's actually measuring what they call detrended core CPI. So it is looking at the change over running baseline. So in actual fact, that peak is where it shows sort of 5 or 6 on the right-hand side of the screen is actually a 9.5. But the point is even if some of these other factors start to weigh in, I think we're looking at extraordinary inflation pressures and high sticky inflation pressures, probably well into Q4. And the implication for other assets are pretty damn clear, I'm afraid.
Julian, I was expecting you to tell me that inflation was going to be the really big thing to pay attention to, because I know you've been on top of the inflation story for a long time. You actually told me off the air that hyperfinancialization is the thing to keep your eye on. Okay, what's what?
What's hyperfinancialization? Call it what you will, but financialization, I think, is this painful situation that we have in the US. And there's, I think, a couple of factors behind it, but I think it's in a way, it's an epitome of extreme capitalism. We've moved to this situation, Eric, where company CEOs are no longer paid to produce anything. Right? They weren't actually until very recently paid even to produce a profit. Right? I think we might have all seen that meme going around where, you know, I think it was from that great HBO series what they did on Silicon Valley, where the guy's like, well, we're going to make a profit. And the venture capitalist guy's like, don't you dare! Don't you dare make any revenue, right? So the point is CEOs are remunerated just simply to do one thing only. And they are shepherds of a stock price. That's the job. The job is to tend the stock price, drive the stock price higher. That is it. So the problem is that when the stock price starts to fall, it elicits a response function, whether it's in terms of employment cutting, and we've seen signs of that already, right? We've seen all these sort of long duration companies that, you know, sort of the names that were in, you know, epitomized by like Cathie Wood and her fund start to lay people off or cut back hiring. And the other place you typically see that manifestation come through is in CapEx. So what tends to follow is that as we start to see these things, the next shoe to drop, and it's strange because this is one of the best economic leading indicators we can use, are the PMIs. So you would think, Eric, that in a world where, you know, you ask the question, which comes first, the chicken or the egg, right? If you think of it in economic and market terms, I mean, really, the chicken should be the real economy, right? The real economy should dictate the level of corporate profits, the level of inflation, and those should feed through into equity markets or bond markets, et cetera, et cetera. That should be logically how this thing happens. It actually isn't. It's actually the chicken is the equity market and the egg is the real economy because of this feedback loop between and the behavior of CEOs. So what's happened is that once you ding stock prices through tighter financial conditions, which Jay Powell has explained to us is how monetary policy works through the system and old macro gets like me and you all along, it starts to elicit a chain reaction. And I think the next chain reaction that we're going to see is a significant drop in the level of some of these confidence metrics, things like the PMIs. We've got ISM manufacturing on Friday. And I think people are going to be shocked at the imminent risk of a recession because I think we are moving rapidly to that point, right? In fact, we have a chart that we look at, you can see on slide 3, this slide here, it shows you corrections in the S&P. And while we aren't there yet, right, we have not dropped 30%. If you go back and you take this chart back, and you can see it goes back 90 years, with the exception of 1987, which Eric, I know you were and I were both around for, maybe in our, you know, very young days, but we were around for, which was really not a bear market per se. It was really a function of, I mean, market terms, you'd call it a negative gamma kind of flash crash caused by this misheld belief in portfolio insurance that they could synthetically create kind of puts until it didn't work and the market crashed. But it was really more of a flash crash. It wasn't really a true economic bear market, and it corrected quite quickly. But with the exception of 87, every single 30% decline in stocks has given you a recession. And the problem is, once you get to that 30% down, doesn't mean you stop at 30% down, because then it's a function of how bad the recession is.
Julian, I want to go back to that point you just made of it doesn't mean you stop when you get to 30% down, because I keep reading more and more commentary with people saying, well, it's unclear as to whether the bottom is in or maybe there's just one more flush down to maybe 3,600 on the S&P, but it can't go any lower than that. Then it'll be all clear. And I'm sort of like, why do you think that? Why can't it go lower? And what am I missing?
No, I think you make a, you know, I look at some metrics, Eric, and I think there's a lot of validity in them. You know, two that I tend to look at, I look at the VIX, and then I look at the, it's a little bit more complicated, the cross-correlation between stocks and the S&P, right? So if you start with the VIX, and you can see that on slide 4, you can look at, if you look at this sort of history of the VIX, it's a bit of a strange beast, in that it tends to sort of trade in bands, okay? It tends to trade in 4 bands, and those 4 bands, if you kind of look at them, let's take band 1, you know, it's almost the inverse of, I can never get this one right, DEFCONs, right? So, you know, you start off in band 1, and that's kind of between 10 and 30, and that's completely normal, okay? You move into band 2, and 2 is sort of 30 to upper 30, 37, 38. You move to band 3, 48 to 53 on the top side. And then you go into move band 4, and that's kind of Armageddon. And if you go back and you look at the last 30 years, there's only 2 occasions, 3 occasions actually, where we got to band 4. the two bad ones, obviously, were the global financial crisis, COVID, and then the bund tantrum, actually, interesting, in 2015, where bund yields doubled or jumped 1% from zero. The other ones, though, we tend to your point, Eric, we don't seem to see that sort of cathartic blow-off move in vol and bottom in the market until at least you've got into band three, right, where you're pushing that upper 40s to lower 50s kind of level. And then you've got things like, you know, Volmageddon, the end of QE1, right? And you can go back into the sort of height of the dot-com crash in 2001 and 2000, and then the broader market in 2002, right? We haven't even got into the bottom of band two, 37, 38. So to me, this just tells me that the pros have been extraordinarily well hedged, right? Extraordinarily well hedged. The second one is this cross correlation between stocks in the S&P. And that's kind of important because the higher the correlation goes towards one, the more and more difficult it is for long, short equity hedge funds to balance their book. Right, because when correlations go to one, there is no hedge. Everything is going down in the same direction. So typically, at sort of market bottoms, you tend to see correlation vols in like 70 to 80, maybe 90. Once again, we're not even close. So I kind of look at this and I think, boy oh boy, you know, people may be very bearish, but they're either hedged or there's this another element, which is what I really fear. And that is the pros are bearish, but they aren't positioned particularly that way. And retail sure as hell isn't positioned that way because they've just been told over the last decade, buy the dip, buy the dip, buy the dip, buy the dip. And most recently, that, you know, bonds are trash in a inflationary environment. And so I'm fearful that we just don't have the conditions for a low. And that really what has to happen for that those conditions to come in is that retail has to be taken to the woodshed and shot through the forehead.
And does that mean that that's coming? And if so, what would be the catalyst to bring it about?
I'm fearful it is coming, right? I'm fearful it is coming because I don't, you know, to go back to that financialization argument, Eric, right? If the Fed is intent on slowing the economy down, which they are, you know, and Powell needs to see, you know, he doesn't want to see it, but he keeps giving those subtle hints. You know, it may require, you know, we might have to see pain, right? Then he's got to tighten financial conditions. He's explained that. That's how monetary policy sends its signals to the economy. And the one element that still is really high and sort of isn't contributing to that real tightening of financial conditions, because it's the sort of five metrics in a financial conditions index, roughly, so the short-term interest rate, long-term interest rates, the currency, credit spreads, and equities. The one bit that is not pulling its weight still is stocks, right? So if stocks don't go down, if stocks try to rally, then the economy, because of that financialization, probably won't slow down as much as you think. And then the Fed will have to keep pushing on rates until stocks get it. So one way or another, stocks have to go. And I think next shoe to drop on stocks is earnings, right? We've seen a P re-rating as bond yields have risen. The discount factor has risen. I think the shoe that has yet to drop is the earnings downgrade. And I think that will start to realize, people start to realize that when we start to get this acceleratively weak economic data, which I think we're on the cusp of seeing and could start as soon as Friday with these ISM manufacturing.
Julian, I want to run a hypothesis past you that a listener sent me, because I've been saying that very similar to what you just said, which is, look, we've seen a very orderly sell-off so far. We haven't seen the panic. We haven't seen the fear. We haven't seen the capitulation. What a listener sent me was a very interesting thought. He said, look, maybe what's going on here is when you see those things, that's the less experienced, younger retail investor panicking. That's the reason we're taught to look for those things. Maybe we're looking in the wrong place, because what younger, less experienced retail investors invest in these days is crypto. And guess what? Crypto is showing plenty of signs of fear, panic, and capitulation. So could it be that the reason we're not seeing fear, panic, and capitulation in the stock market is because the demographic, which is vulnerable to having that experience, is in the crypto market instead?
I think that's fair. So I think that is, you've taken those guys out and you've shot, right? But they're the millennials, right? They control a fraction of the wealth. Who controls the wealth, Eric? The boomers. They've not been trading crypto. What are they trading? They're trading stocks. How are they trading stocks? Well, if they're wealthy, they've got a registered investment advisor, right? They've got a broker. Do you think their brokers told them to get out? Those guys haven't been trained to tell them to get out, right? So it's when these guys, and I can tell you in conversations I've had with wealth managers and private family offices, they are all gagging for a rally so they could try and get out. No one saw this coming. No capitulation. Now, maybe they don't capitulate, but it's kind of hard to see that because a lot of these guys are coming up to retirement, right? So you've got to imagine if you got a, you know, a rally, that they'd be sellers on a rally, right? Same as pension funds, right? I mean, if you're a pension fund and you just got given, you know, you just caught the Hail Mary pass because you were underwater in terms of your funding, equities have risen, and now, and you were long a lot of equities, and now you can go and sell those equities and go and lock in decent bond yields. Wouldn't you do that? So I just think minimum, there's a hell of a lot of supply on the top side. Worst case, they just haven't capitulated yet.
You mentioned bond yields, so let's move on to that because, you know, with this inflation situation, a lot of people are saying, okay, seems like Jay Powell wants to be the new Paul Volcker, so we're headed to 20% interest rates. But wait a minute, Paul Volcker said before he died that that approach that he took in the early 1980s would never work today because we've got so much more debt to contend with. So what is going to happen with respect to bond yields? It seems like the prescription here is increase treasury yields as much as possible to fight inflation. But now we've got a situation where increasing those treasury real yields could crash everything. And I guess the corollary to that question is, where does it leave high yield?
So I think, yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, we're not going to get rates back to Paul Volcker type levels. I mean, it doesn't mean that we can't do, say, the damage that Paul Volcker did. But I don't think, you know, my analogy is we're not really in the 70s yet because of the dollar. You know, that was the real thing that drove the extended inflation that we got. But people forget that the real inflation that led to the 70s started in the late 60s. And that's kind of where I think we're, is much more an analogous period historically. And, you know, back then, the Fed was trying to do their best to try and fight this inflation. And I think Jay Powell has certainly told us he's intent to try and do his best. He's, you know, to use that phrase, girded his loin. And, you know, he's prepared to fight to do this. And he made it, as did Lagarde and as did Bailey. They all made it very, very clear on this video call this morning, on this conference that they spoke to this morning in Sinta for the ECB, that they were all, that the biggest risk was not the pain. The biggest risk was letting inflation get out of the jar. Kind of think that's a bit late. So there's a big difference though, right? There's a big difference what central banks say and what markets price. I mean, the market has been much more aggressive at pricing in rate moves than the Fed. And the Fed, I think, or the other central banks, and it's part of the game, right? You kind of hope that the market does a lot of your work for you in using forward guidance. And so maybe at the end of the day, you don't have to fully deliver that in terms of actual rate hikes. That's how tightening financial conditions works. And we've seen that. So bond markets really kind of priced in an awful lot. The question is going to be, though, what happens next? So if growth, as I said, I think inflation is certainly going to move higher in the Eurozone. I think in the US, it's going to be at best sticky, maybe even still slightly higher. That's going to make things very difficult to balance. I think it's going to make things very difficult for the central banks to back off. But if you start to get materially weaker data in terms of growth, Eric, what the bond market is going to start to do is go, aha, Okay. I know you say, you know, which is where the Fed is, that the terminal rate, the highest rate that rates are going to go, okay, is 3.8. You're not getting there, mate. You're not going to get there because I know I can smell already that by the time you get anywhere close, you'll have shanked the equity market and the real economy will be down the plug hole. Okay. So the market, I think, is starting to bet on that. And you can see that really at the front end of the bond market, right, in kind of the 2-year euro dollar sector, you know, 2-year yields. That's what the market is beginning to smell. And that's actually what typically happens, Eric, ahead of a recession. Okay. So I know a lot of your guys are interested in the equity market, but please, please, please never listen to an equity guy pontificating about the bond market because they wouldn't understand it if it bit them in the arse. Okay. You constantly hear things on CNBC when guys go, these commentators who aren't even market participants, they're journalists in most cases, saying things like, oh, well, you know, the curve inversion is a sign of the bond market pricing in a recession. So in other words, you know, 2-year yields are higher than 30-year yields or 10-year yields, right? That's the inverted curve. That's utterly wrong. A curve inversion, particularly in that, in this type of the point in the cycle, is the bond market anticipating central bank hikes, okay? And longer yield term yields either fall or remain anchored as those front yields move higher because central banks are moving to deal with inflation. I don't have to be that concerned about my yields further out because I know the central bank is doing the right thing to maintain the value of my bonds by tackling inflation. But what actually happens right before the recession is actually called the bull steepener. And the bull steepener, it's a bull move because the bond market is rallying, yields are falling, okay, is when 2-year yields fall relative to the long end. So the curve steepens, but it's because bond yields at the front drop. And that's where the bond market, as I said, goes through that guessing game where they go, I know what you think you're doing, Federal Reserve or ECB. You think you're going to get rates to this level. You're not, because I could already see the cracks starting to form in the economy. And so that's where I think we're at that phase. I think it's still difficult because of this background inflation. But if the data is sufficiently weak, Eric, which I fear it's going to be, then that will, the front end of the bond market will start to look through the inflation data and go, look, at some point, I know, even if it drags on for another 3 to 6 months, that this inflation will wane because we'll be in a deep, ugly recession. Okay. And I know that central banks are never going to get there.
Julian, for most of the 20-teens, I kept telling myself that the trade of the century, when it was time, was going to be shorting junk bonds. Except I tried too many times too early and lost money each time. Is it finally time to short junk bonds?
It's kind of difficult because of the tools that you have available. So in late November, we put on a trade in HYG. And it was a put spread on HYG. We said it was a super, super cheap hedge. And it was. And it was a blowout trade. Eric, I mean, we got it on at incredibly, incredibly good levels. Thing was barely off the highs. And the problem is that that's probably the easiest thing to trade, and it's moved a long way, right? It's moved mostly on the back of duration. So in other words, the bond market move, because it's, remember, it, you know, credit bonds or high yield has two elements, has the duration element, just like a regular sovereign bond, and then it also has the credit spread. I do think there's now a significant risk that the credit spread component, Eric, starts to move. But it's quite difficult to play that given how much HYG has already moved. I mean, there's some, you know, of these other things you can start to play. I just think at this point, the better trade is just slot equities.
Now, inflation has moved exactly as you predicted it would. What surprised a lot of people is precious metals. Gold is really languishing here. We haven't seen a big move up. We got the geopolitical pop when the war broke out between Russia and Ukraine. That's pretty much retraced now. As we're speaking on Wednesday, we're just moved today below all of the cluster of moving averages. chart's not looking good. How can that be when inflation is such a problem?
Precious metals are not really a hedge on inflation. I mean, they're non-yielding, right? So they're not really a great inflation hedge. What they're a really good hedge on is lack central banking, which often goes hand in hand in, you know, with inflation, but at the moment isn't, right? I mean, if you look at if you look at gold, it tends to be inversely correlated to bond yields, right? And got a tough central bank here, so you know it's a tough one to own in that kind of environment. I mean, frankly, you know, I think it's done remarkably well to hold in as well as it should. I mean, if you look at the move in, you know, and you can see that in 5-5. If you look at here, 10-year yields against gold, you can see that really gold has held up remarkably well. It's inversely correlated, has been since 2009 very closely to those bond yields. It's held up remarkably well in this move from bond yields from like 1.5 to 3.5 at the highs, right? To be honest, it probably should be down at $1,400 or lower. So it's done well. I think that's because there's other, you know, non-economically sensitive buyers coming through. But when precious metals do remarkably well is when the dollar tends to weaken, right? And the dollar won't weaken until the Fed is forced in a corner and has to capitulate on, because either we've got a super deep recession and bond yields are high relatively, and they are forced to come in and kind of save those two bits of the economy. It's this dilemma which we think we're coming to face, which is basically called the impossible trinity in economic terms. You've got three variables. In this case, it's the equity market, the bond market, and the currency. Which two do you save? Because you can't control all three, right? We think the Fed, if we're right about this next leg of the equity market falling, Eric, let's say we do a dot-com type burst, you know, by the time this thing is down, it's down, you know, the S&P's down 30%+, the NASDAQ's down 40%, or worse, right? Or worse, you know, bond yields are say very sticky still because we've still got that background benign inflation. And that's not inconceivable, right? Remember, guys, we've seen this before. If you look at slide 6, you'll see a period where in the late 60s, bond yields rose and stocks fell, right? Can happen because inflation's rising. But I think, you know, at some point, the Fed will capitulate. They'll have to. When they do, that's when I think the dollar goes. We're not there yet. But when that happens, that's when you really load up on precious metals, and particularly silver. It's just, as I said, it's really a, precious metals are not so much as a inflation play, not when the central banks are trying to be tough to address it. When precious metals come to their own is when you've got weak, ineffective central banks, or central banks that are forced to make unpleasant choices where they're looking at these three variables and which two do they save. Not there yet.
Julian, I'm tempted to ask you, okay, what's the magic number on the S&P where you start buying because the bottom is in? Of course, most of our listeners are smart enough to know it's not quite that simple. But let's talk in terms of analogs to other bear markets. What are the signs we would look for, or how would we tell when the bottom really is in or approaching being in? Because it sounds like you and I both agree we're not there yet. How do you know when you are there, and how do you know when it's time to start buying?
So I think there's all those other various signs that we talked about, like the capitulation signs, Eric. And I think, you know, we'd sort of agree that basically we aren't there yet. I think, you know, the other thing is to look at analogies in history. And I think the one that is most close to this is the dot-com bubble, right? And the reason I say that is I think we've had one of these periods of what I would call exceptionalism. They happen kind of all around the world, but the US is typically prone to them because it's the reserve currency. And that's periods where you get currency strength, in our case, the dollar, that are associated with equity market strength and equity and market outperformance. So if you kind of look at the US from sort of 95 to 2002, you had a period of dollar strength and a period of relative outperformance of the US equity market versus the rest of the world. And that obviously led to the dot-com bubble. And the reason for that is very simple. Foreigners basically get two for one, right? It's the classic two-fist trade, right? You can buy the currency and you can buy the equities, and both of them outperform. And this one has actually run arguably twice as long. Really started in 2011 and with Earnest in, since 2014. And once again, this incredible power sucked in money into the US. And it truly is reflexive in that kind of Soros sense of the word, Eric, right? Where the purchase of the asset actually leads to an outperformance and underpins the performance of that asset itself. So it becomes self-perpetuating until it kind of isn't. So I think that that relationship needs to start breaking down for users to have a chance to see that this is over. But if you look at that dot-com period, the important thing to remember is that whole process took time to burst, Eric, right? So we kind of burst the NASDAQ in March of 2000. The S&P pretty much held in until September of 2000. And then the Dow really until May of 2001. So a full 14 months after. And if I know this probably will have upset some of your listeners, hopefully they will have taken some lessons from it. But, you know, I constantly tweet about Cathie Wood, right? I mean, I think, you know, she's been a horse for a single course, right? She did exceptionally well in free money and playing long duration stocks. And I do not believe that her fund will come back for a number of years. And I don't think you're going to see your money back to the highs for a decade. But, you know, the chart porn, and I'll call it that, where you compared the price fraction of Cathie Wood's fund, and you can see it in slide 7, you compare, you know, Cathie Wood's fund against the NASDAQ in 2000. I mean, it's the same chart, Eric. I mean, it's literally the same chart. So if you say Cathie Wood's fund was that, and that burst in Feb of last year, right, it's about now that you should be expecting to see the weakness in the equity market, and we have. Right, the question is how far does this run? Because in 2000, these corrections were brutal, mate. Right? I mean, you remember this. I mean, this was not a 30%, oh, and we're all done, walk away. You know, that's great. That's fine, right? I mean, the NASDAQ dropped 77%. It didn't base until 2 years later. The S&P dropped 72%. And even the Dow, which was the big market back then, dropped 56%. I mean, I think arguably this market has gone on for twice as long as those. I think, you know, the dynamics are hugely dangerous. So I'm in no rush. I don't think you have to be, as I said, I with this inflationary backdrop, I think it's going to be very difficult for central banks. Even if growth starts to stumble, it's going to be very difficult for central banks to, I don't say they won't stop if growth goes weak enough, but to come in with another bout of QE or something, right? Or to give you rate cuts. I think that's going to be very, very difficult to do. And I think the risks are of a growing of a very ugly recession potentially because of this financialization on the back of that. And so I'm not saying that we're going to go down 77%, you know, 72% on the S&P, but 40% isn't inconceivable, Eric. And that's why I don't think you need to be in a rush, because the only reason why you need to be in a rush in the last decade is you were trying to anticipate a Fed coming to your rescue. That was it. Right? You got those big, sharp bounces. But often equity markets aren't like, I mean, most of the equity market prior to 08 weren't like that, right? I mean, you at least had 6 to 8 months where the market kind of stabilized, right? And then started to move higher. I mean, the NASDAQ made its low in October of 02, right? It was pretty much unchanged for another year. So you had plenty of time to kind of think about it. There was no V-shaped bottom. So I don't know when anyone needs to be in a rush right now.
I just want to interject for anyone who's not familiar. Cathie Wood is the manager of the ARK funds. She's known as one of the biggest cheerleaders for stocks like Tesla and other companies whose new paradigms in her analysis mean that they don't necessarily need to have the types of earnings that are normally associated with profitable companies and so forth. I was trying to be gentle. What are you laughing at?
Sorry, I just when you if you take a step back and you actually listen to that, it is and you're absolutely right. That's her monologue, right? it's a bizarre bloody monologue to convince you to put money into something, right?
Well, it sounded good to a lot of people when those stocks were going up. She was saying, don't worry about earnings. It's a new paradigm. It's a different kind of system. You don't have to worry about the old normal. It doesn't apply here because it's a different kind of company. And that worked for a while, didn't it?
It did work extraordinarily well. So, right? It's just cynical old bastards like us have seen it before, right? We heard the same thing in the dot-com bubble, right? Don't look at this, you know, look at it against revenue, look at it at X times sales, look at it at this, right?
Well, if that doesn't work out, we'll just make up for it with volume. That was my favorite one. Let's move on, Julian. Final question. First of all, I'm with you. I don't think this is over yet in the equity market. I don't think there's any reason to rush in and start buying the bottom because I don't think we've seen the bottom yet. But hold on. You're saying it could be quite a while. So what do you do to make money now? Where is the trade? That it sounds like you're saying it's a little bit late to get on the short side of this market. What do you do?
I mean, it's not necessarily too late. I mean, if we're right, we've still got, in percentage terms, a lot further to go, right? So if you've been sitting here, you know, and that water's starting to feel a little hot, doesn't mean you can't try and raise some cash. Remember, I mean, unless you're getting new chunks of cash in, you need to have some cash to take advantage of those lows, right? That's the fallacy of a lot of brokers, right? They say you can't time the market, which is bizarre because there's a whole bloody industry that does it and makes lots of profit out of it. And then they said, you know, because you'll never get back in. Well, the trick is obviously to get back in. But, you know, they're the ones who are incapable of telling you to get back in, not you. So I think, as I said, I think there's potentially, Eric, some opportunities to be had at the very front end of the bond market. So kind of 2 years. But I really, really don't think so, that it's wrong having cash for a while. Right? I mean, I really, really think it's important to have cash.
Now, you're sure. Mr. Inflation, Julian, and normally cash and inflation don't mix.
Let's say you sit with it for 6 months, right? And you get a 5% erosion.
Or you could buy sriracha sauce with it. And
yeah. I mean, no, but I mean, let's say you put it in 2-year treasuries, right? And they don't go down, they don't go up. You earn, you know, 1%. And then you've got erosion of 4, okay? We've seen those intraday in the NASDAQ. Really? I mean, you can't take that? I genuinely think you can. I think you I would say, you know, maybe corporate high yield. But as I said to you, I think the next shoe to drop for that is actually the credit spreads. Credit spreads are pretty tight, actually. Credit spreads are remarkably tight. You know, if you take something like triple C's against B's, Eric, they're about 400 basis points. If we're going into anything close to a real recession, right, you know, let's say ISM significantly under 50, those things should be 600 basis points. So I can't even tell you there that I think there's advantages. I mean, I really think at the moment, I mean, precious metals aren't bad. They're not going to go too far. I don't think that, you know, gold is quite heavily owned, but it's got a bid. Silver, I think, could come down a little bit. It's not going to go down as much. I think, you know, personally, I'm long quite a few things that I want to be long, but I have shorts against them. And the reason is simple. This is, if you go and you look at that, and I, you know, look at slide 8. This is a final slide. You'll see the growth value S&P chart, right? Going back to the dot-com period. And you can use anything. I mean, this is S&P growth value, but you could use US emerging markets. You could use tech, mining, metals, energy, right? Whatever those ratios, they're all basically the same. Tech, the US growth has utterly outperformed the rest of the world, just like it did into the dot-com bubble. Now, I think we're halfway through the correction in that ratio, but as you know, Eric, ratios can correct one of two ways, okay? There's the nice correction, all right? So let's say US tech goes nowhere and mining metals, Europe, emerging markets, you know, energy rises, right? So the ratio corrects the nice way. And then there's the nasty way, And the nasty way is everything drops, but just tech drops the most. The US drops the most. Well, the problem is this is like, I always love this one. This is like the fund manager who says to you, I beat the index. You're like, oh, great. Yeah, you know, the index is down 20 and I'm only down 10. Cheers, mate, you just lost me 10% of my money. Right? That's the problem with the nasty phase, right? And the nasty phase persists until the central banks blink. That was the lesson of the dot-com bubble. Until the Fed blinked and the dollar started to weaken, initiating the next wave of inflation and reflation, you got the nasty correction. I think we're in that phase. So unless you can hold ratios where you're long this and short that, and even that can be difficult, cash is not a bad thing. I mean, I want to buy silver at some point. I think I'm going to get it probably in the mid-19s in a blow-off, because I don't think it's very heavily owned, Eric, but it's owned. And you, when you get that VAR event, right, we talked about that big spike in vol, the big spike in cross correlations where everything just pukes, even the stuff that you want to own is going to go down. So cash is fine.
Well, Julian, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to talk a little bit about what you do at MI2 Partners. Now, you cautioned our listeners earlier in this interview not to let guys that do nothing but stocks try to lecture you on the bond market. You have for decades now been an institutional macro advisor talking about the big picture of all of these asset classes. Give us a little bit of a sense of what you do there and how our listeners can follow your work.
Right. So MI2 Partners has been around now for 11 years. So we survived that threshold of 10, which is, you know, kind of the last point where companies, you know, startups tend to fold. If you make it past that, you're pretty much golden. So fingers crossed. And you can visit us at mi2partners.com. You can express your interest if you want to see the research there. There's ways to sign up, or you could just reach out to support@mi2partners.com. And then we have, as you've talked about in the past, Eric, this joint venture that we have with Raoul Powell at Real Vision called Macro Insiders. And we shoot, you know, the shit with each other basically once a month. And we send, you know, our institutional research to clients. So we may differ at times, but that I think is hugely important for clients. But many times we start to agree. And now it's kind of one of those times we're getting a bit closer. And there's actually a special on at the moment. So I think if they go to the Real Vision site or they look on my Twitter, which is the other way to follow me. So if you don't want to pay for anything and you just want to follow the freebies, at JulianMI2 on Twitter. And I'm also on LinkedIn if you prefer that. But yeah, that's kind of how you can follow us. And we don't just pontificate, Eric. We try and pay people money, right? We are not just economists by any stretch of the imagination. We try and get real trading profits.
Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this. After being completely sold out of advertising space for the last couple of years, we finally have capacity to add a new advertiser. Macro Voices has a Podtrac certified global audience of over 170,000 listeners, and each weekly episode typically gets 60,000 to 80,000 downloads. We have more than 20,000 accredited investors who have registered with us as accredited, and we estimate the total accredited investor audience as at least 40,000 accredited listeners, which we believe to be the highest number of accredited investor listeners of any podcast on the internet. We strive to accept tasteful advertising from advertisers whose product is likely to appeal to our audience. So we're looking for another investment or financial services advertiser to fill the space I'm speaking in right now. Mail order Viagra salesmen need not apply. If your company wants to advertise on Macro Voices, please email sponsorship@macrovoices.com for more information. Now let's get right back to the show.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, it's so great to have Julian back on the show. You know, I remember when he was on the show many months back, he was already identifying all of the cracks in the armor and the vulnerability to the equity markets. He was so bang on then. And the fact that he continues to be concerned about the markets is certainly something I would take very seriously. What did you take away from his interview?
Well, the biggest conclusion I came to from this interview was actually bigger picture. It's just another in a series of the smartest guys that we have on Macro Voices all saying different versions of the same thing for different reasons, whether it's Darius Dale or Julian Brigden or any of the recent guests that we've had. Pretty much everybody is saying this ain't over until it's over. We actually had a debate about what to title this episode because we wanted to say it's, you know, the bottom's not in yet. And it's like, wait a minute, isn't that the title of the last three episodes? You know, we were struggling to be creative about changing the title name because it seems like the theme has been so consistent that so many of our smartest guests are all saying that this equity sell-off is not done yet. It's got further to go to the downside, and the fireworks have yet to begin. In any event, Patrick, let's move on to this week's post-game chart deck, which is titled Snapshot of the Intermarkets. Listeners, you'll find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, page two is the S&P 500 Continuous Futures Chart. What are we looking at here?
Well, listen, I wanted to throw that, use the 50-day moving average this week. You know, I don't like to market time necessarily off the 50-day, but I like to use it as a gauge for the primary trend to sort of see what's going on and which way the markets are moving. And we can clearly see the S&P 500 obviously was oversold. It bounced toward that 50-day moving average. And in arguably, there could still be one more short-term rally that even approaches it one more time, as it's common to see like a zigzagging style price action going toward it. But in my mind, so long as this market stays in that downwards channel and continuously fails all of its rally attempts at these kind of basic moving averages, one must step back and accept that the primary downtrend is the dominant trend. And while everyone would love to fish for a bottom, there just isn't enough evidence out there in the markets that a market bottom has formed. And so I think the takeaway here is just respect the primary trend.
Well, Patrick, I couldn't agree more. It does look like maybe we've got room for one more push up before we hit that 50-day moving average again. But just look visually at this chart. You can draw that downsloping price channel with your mind's eye, and it's a nice clear cut, you know, looks like a downsloping and steeply downsloping price channel. And I suspect that we've got quite a ways left to go to the downside. Let's move on to the NASDAQ chart on page three. What are we looking at here?
Well, it's just the same chart, but what's interesting is the NASDAQ continues to be the much weaker market. And at this moment, each breakdown sequence makes lower highs, lower lows, and the rallies in the NASDAQ have just been so much weaker. And while there's more natural implied volatility in the NASDAQ, so on a percentage basis, day in, day out, it's easy to compare that, oh, the NASDAQ's, let's say, up more or down more than the S&P, but I don't like to weigh it that way. I look at it really as a significance of how big are the swings relative to where it's coming from. And the NASDAQ just continues to be an incredibly weak chart. And I find it very hard to imagine the S&P recovering without there being some structurally stronger basing developing in where almost all the selling originates from, which is in the unprofitable tech spaces and the FANG stocks due to these multiples. But and nonetheless, I just wanted to highlight that weakness. I want to move on, though, Eric, to page four, where I have that euro. And you know that while we look at that Dixie at least, always in the market wrap, the euro is the largest component. And we always are just watching if there's any significant changes in this major currency pair. And what we continue to see is an incredibly weak currency that continues to bounce along along a key support line. And what's amazing about that kind of 104 area, give or take 50 pips, is that that's the decade lows. And if we see the euro give that zone out on the downside as each rally fails at below that 50-day moving average, I don't see how parity wouldn't be in the target of a next drop. And so this is such an important support line, and just discovering whether the euro holds it has got to be like one of the top things for traders to watch. But moving on, Eric, I wanted to touch on crude oil. I want to first give you my little technical take on this, and then I'd love to hear what you're thinking as well, expanding on what you were talking about in the market wrap. But when I look at this chart, we're pivoting off that 50-day moving average. Now, the pullback in crude oil that went down towards 100 didn't get down there, but that sell-off, while it broke the 50-day moving average, has more or less found support at what were its previous highs, and essentially has been just a basic Fibonacci retracement of its prior run from March up till June. And so to me, the technical damage isn't there yet on crude. Arguably, if we see any recovery of crude oil back to 110 in the coming several trading sessions and things just keep grinding higher a little bit, I actually would not take an upside move on crude oil off the table. But this is such a critical moment. Because if the selling ensues and we have 104, 103 failed rallies and everything starts getting very heavy, then those lower target zones that you just talked about in the market wrap become a reality and such an important moment in crude. What's your take?
Well, I agree, Patrick. And, you know, it's funny, we just had that 110 test overnight last night, but it didn't last. As we went into the OPEC Plus meeting this morning, we saw a big sell-off. And, you know, we still haven't priced in the reality of the recession that's coming. And I think it may be not just a U.S. recession, but a global economic recession that we're headed towards. So I think it's, you know, another $10 down from here wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. It would also not deter me in the slightest from my much longer term, very, very bullish view, because we're out of spare capacity and oil fields inherently decline in production. They produce less and less over time. They have to be replaced by drilling new oil wells. And we're not making those investments to replace declining resources with new resources. So ultimately, without spare capacity, with potentially even before you consider an escalation with Russia, I think we're looking at higher prices still to come. As we get into the Russia side of this, you know, everybody's talking about these Western sanctions as if they're the holy grail. In reality, Western sanctions aren't doing anything to take Russian oil off the market. Russia is still selling its oil. They have record high profits from their oil because Western sanctions have had the effect of pushing the price up based on speculation that that Russian oil was coming off the market. But the oil's not really off the market. They can sell it to China and India, who will continue to buy it. And China and India will buy less oil from Saudi Arabia, and Saudi Arabia will sell more oil to Europe. And it all balances out. It's a fungible commodity. And therefore, because it's a fungible commodity, it's not possible to impose a price cap or to levy meaningful sanctions unless you're willing to go to the level of something like a military blockade to physically force Russia to be unable to export its oil. And guess what? You're dealing with a nuclear superpower. That's a really good way to end humanity on the planet for everyone by getting into a nuclear escalation. So I really hope they don't go in that direction. But I want you to just imagine a thought experiment, Patrick. Suppose that Vladimir Putin was on the phone right now with Xi Jinping and saying, look, here's what's going on. The West are playing this political theater game with their sanctions that don't really mean anything. We need to make a plan, Xi. Here's what I want you to do. Buy Russian oil from us this summer so that we can kind of bankroll those profits. We're going to need them. You're going to need the oil. Trust me on that. And when we get to the situation come October or so, when Europe really, really needs our gas, that's when we're going to play hardball. And maybe we'll turn off the gas and the oil, and we'll say Russia is not willing to sell any of that gas or oil to the West at any price. Now, Xi, I'm going to need you to help me because we can't just shut in our oil wells. That's a very expensive process. We're going to have to keep producing through that period. So why don't you start right now just doing whatever you can to buy ships, to build tanks, do whatever you can to increase your own SPR capacity so that in that period when we stop selling to the West, you're still buying enough of our oil to keep that production online, but you're not going to be reducing your consumption elsewhere. You're going to continue to buy the oil that you are actually consuming from Saudi Arabia and other OPEC plus producers. And you're going to buy enough Russian oil in order to keep us going. That's going to allow us to put a major squeeze on to where we take oil prices to $250. You're going to be really happy that you bought all of that extra Russian crude over the summer and into the fall at discounted prices, because we're going to really squeeze the West when we get to the time when they can least tolerate it. And oh, by the way, that European heating season just happens to set things up perfectly for a big squeeze higher in prices right around the time of U.S. midterm elections. Why wouldn't, if you were Putin, why wouldn't you be having that conversation with Xi Jinping right now? Now, I don't know if that's the way it's going to play out. There's probably 1,000 variations of that story you could make up in your head. My point is, Russia is not even playing hardball with the West yet, and I predict that that is still to come. So I think that we have a setup for massively, massively higher prices in months and years ahead. But in the meantime, we still haven't priced in a U.S. recession, and I don't think most of the market has come to terms with the true significance of OPEC Plus being out of spare capacity. One of the reasons for that is OPEC Plus is not really in a position to explain the significance of being out of spare capacity, because to explain that would kind of defeat the purpose of OPEC Plus existing. If there's no more pricing power by managing production, then there's really no reason for a cartel to exist. OPEC Plus doesn't have any power. So they can't admit to that publicly, and I don't think the market has really figured out how dire the spare capacity situation truly is.
Eric, though, take a look at this Nat Gas chart on page 6, and just a substantial material breakdown in energy prices when looking at it from Nat Gas perspective. Not only did it fail over the last 2 weeks to recover that big breakdown, but it just seems now the selling is just feeding on itself. And I viewed that $6 to $6.50 area to being a kind of key level where if it was just a pullback, some sort of a retracement and a resumption of trend, that we should have seen some sort of buying come from that level. And instead, the selling is relentless. And this really puts to question as to whether or not we're heading right back down to the bottom end of Nat Gas trading ranges over the summer. Any thoughts on this?
Well, I think that what drove that first break was the explosion in Texas, where we basically lost a nat gas export facility. That means less gas is going to be exported to Europe. And I think in the fallout, in the wake of that event, I think the market has kind of figured out that that was an unrealistic plan that was really more political rhetoric than reality to start with. As far as where it goes down from here, I still have to admit, this much weakness in nat gas and this much weakness in oil that we're already seeing even before the stock market begins to truly price in a recession really is a big question mark. I feel like there's something that I don't understand yet. There's something I'm not seeing in the market. Maybe there are actors in the market who are operating on inside information that we don't have yet, but it does feel like something has changed. The whole $22 sell-off in crude oil doesn't really make sense to me, and I don't think anybody has really articulated a good explanation of why that happened or why the Nat Gas chart is suddenly looking so weak when a lot of very, very smart analysts were expecting that Nat Gas prices in the U.S. would eventually converge with European Nat Gas prices.
All right, Eric, let's move on to the silver chart. What I wanted to just simply highlight, like gold is just approaching key support lines. And, you know, you could argue that it's going to come and retest key supports and hold. But silver, which is considered, you know, the trading cousin of gold, tends to have strong correlation. But what's surprising about silver is how it gave out all of the 2021 support lows. And the rally that it had here going into June failed to actually get back into the trade range. What was previous lows acting as overhead resistance, failing at that 50-day moving average, rolling over. It just, it's so weak and vulnerable. Like the question I'm, you know, in the back of my mind thinking is there a journey for silver to head down into the mid-teens during a deeper pullback, especially if the whole stock market has a liquidity event? Silver tends to fall into that basket, like you were saying with gold, is that all correlation of these assets goes to one and these things start to all drop. Definitely this chart just looks so weak here.
Well, silver has much more speculative interest in it. And with the whole Wall Street silver trend, I think it has a lot of less experienced investors in that long speculative trade. I'd actually say, Patrick, that the biggest surprise in this week's feature interview with Julian Brigden was when he said he hoped to be a buyer of silver at a low 19 handle. I was thinking low teens, not low 19. And the reason I say that is, as you just said, if we see a stock market, which is already selling off, but selling off in a very orderly fashion, if that becomes disorderly and we get an outright crash in the stock market, it's going to cause retail investors particularly to panic. There's more of them in silver than in gold, and I could see a washout in silver. It would be a terrific buying opportunity for sure, but I could see the numbers going a heck of a lot lower than Julian's number of 19.
Yeah, well, just to put some reference that's not showing on the chart, the 2016 through to 2019 lows were all in that kind of $14 to $17, or at least the major trade ranges were in that kind of $14 to $17 range. Obviously, we had a $12 silver during the COVID crash, but that was an incredibly temporary small dip down there that lasted just a few days. So, you know, to me, while I think you're right, it's somewhere in, I'm in between you and Julian. Like, I think the risk here below 19 is very real, but I don't know whether low teens is going to be the target. I think that kind of $14 to $16 pocket would be the kind of moment where I would feel a much higher conviction to put some risk on in silver if we got down there. I've been long in hedging silver and my hedges are working, but right now this chart really does look weak, and down is the vulnerable a path of least resistance for that. Let's move on to copper. And here's another chart that is just so surprising to me. I mean, copper had that amazing run through 2020, going into 2021, where the ESG movement had everyone certain that copper had a future and a big upside going to, you know, $6, $7+ on the upside. Yet after almost a year and a half sideways trade range in copper with failed rally attempts, this breakdown is now a legitimate new downtrend. And, you know, I have to ask as to whether or not 350 or more is in the cards, considering copper is so economically sensitive to recessions. They call it Dr. Copper for a reason. And with this type of a downtrend and these kind of weak bounces, it just feels like there's more downside here.
I think you're probably right that there's more downside. And the problem with this chart, as you say, it's tempting to think, okay, Dr. Copper is usually the first chart to predict when a U.S. recession is about to hit. Maybe what we're seeing in this big drop in the last several weeks is copper is starting to price in that recession that I'm convinced is not too far off in the future. The thing is that there's been so much upside in copper that was ESG speculation about, oh, we're going to go all to electric vehicles, it's going to change everything, and so on and so forth. I think that's actually good speculation. I think that that was a good argument because we do need to move off of fossil fuels. The mistakes that the Biden administration is making is that they're trying to phase out fossil fuels before their replacement has been phased in, which is incredibly reckless and stupid. But it doesn't mean that we don't still need to phase in the replacement. We just need to be realistic about the time frame that's going to be required. So I think that as we do price a recession, there's probably more downside to copper. At some point, it's going to bottom, and I think it's going to be a heck of a buying opportunity. I hope I'm smart enough to buy a whole bunch of it pretty close to the bottom, because ultimately, we do need to electrify the economy. It's not going to happen as quickly as the greenies would like to pretend it's going to happen, but it needs to happen. It's going to require a lot of copper, and the ESG movement is going to eventually be rejuvenated and continue to punish extractive industries like mining, and that's just going to put that much more pressure on supply. So I am very bullish copper prices in the long run, but there's plenty of room for this dip to dip much farther down.
All right. Well, in the final two charts I have here, I wanted to look at lumber and on uranium prices. But lumber really started to show the signs of a recession and the demand for housing and things like this, with returning all the way back down to its August 2021 lows, more than a 50% wipeout in lumber prices over the last 3-4 months. We're now coming to a pretty important support line and initially bouncing here. I'm very curious to see whether after a short-term oversold bounce here, whether we're heading right back down to the lows later in the summer. I mean, this really just is such an awful chart, but it's just at a support. So it'll be interesting to see whether this level holds. With that said, Eric, I wanted to just touch on that uranium chart. All these commodities, they're all doing the same thing. It's amazing how the entire commodity complex in the last few months has turned so decisively. Like, it literally is just a few handful commodities with crude oil that have been able to weather the storm on this turn. And we have just seen such deep corrections and distributions really kick in this entire space. Now, the difference here, unlike copper, uranium is holding those 2021 support lows along this $13 level on the Sprott physical uranium. But this chart is so weak and the rallies are failing so much. It's going to be such an interesting tug of war as to whether the support holds or whether the prevailing downtrend remains dominant. One of them is about to win next week. But right now, with the way the whole market looks, it doesn't bode well. We may see one quick break here that could see uranium head right back to those levels that it traded back through April through July. And so that's certainly something that I'm going to be watching into next week.
Well, Patrick, I think it just creates a buying opportunity. The question is whether the bottom is in yet, and I don't know how to tell the answer to that on this particular chart. Uranium is such a volatile commodity. At some point, though, I think we go much higher as we realize that we need atomic energy, and it really is part of the ESG revolution. You know, the greenies love to talk about how important sustainable energy is. And they're right. We need to focus on renewable, sustainable energy sources. They've got that right. Now, why they can't get to the next step, which is the best renewable and most sustainable energy source, is atomic energy. Who knows? It just seems to be outside the culture of the green movement to recognize the obvious. Someday, reality is going to hit us in the face, and we're going to have to confront it, and we're going to realize that we need atomic power in order to get off of fossil fuels and move forward with the economy. Listeners, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading, Patrick's trading service. Information's on page 12 of the chart deck, or you can find it at bigpicturetrading.com. We're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, this week you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the slide deck from Julian, as well as the chart book that we just discussed here in the postgame, as well as a number of links to articles that we found really interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. That does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at Macro Voices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow me on Twitter at Patrick Serezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.